100 days in captivity for Nigeria's missing girls. Today, Tuesday, July 22nd, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman. Nigeria's president finally meets with parents of the kidnapped girls. This journalist says the pressure of the 100-day mark has refocused attention on the girls' plight.
Even if it wasn't priority for Nigerians last week, it certainly is now.
Also today, the conflict in Gaza and Hamas's changing tactics against Israel.
They're fighting. They're standing their ground, where before they've cut and run.
And later playing nine-man in Chinatown. It's like volleyball, only more intense.
Suicide is the person that picks up all the hooks, the really fast ones. So it's all coming to your face. So it's kind of dangerous, I guess.
Those stories ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. We start today with a subject that can divide nations or a government or even a family. That subject is Israel's ground incursion into Gaza, and specifically whether it's time for an immediate ceasefire. The diplomatic push for a ceasefire is gaining momentum as casualties, particularly civilian casualties, mount in Gaza. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said today he had constructive talks on a possible truce with officials in Cairo. But while the talking goes on, so too does the fighting. We've got BuzzFeed's Shira Frankel on the line now from Jerusalem. And Shira, it's been an especially violent few days on the ground in Gaza. Where do things stand right now?
At the moment, Israel is still going forward with its ground offensive in Gaza, and we're still hearing about casualties on both sides. It doesn't seem like the violence is going to let up anytime soon. In fact, just this afternoon, I spoke with an Israeli army official who said that they're moving even further towards the west in Gaza, towards the sea. And we've heard of Israeli Navy boats edging closer and closer to the shore. So it doesn't seem like they're de-escalating anytime soon.
There were stories today that an Israeli soldier is missing. Do we know anything about him?
So that's been kind of a confusing story, and there have been a few different narratives around about that. What we know is that over the weekend on Saturday, there was an APC that was attacked and very badly scorched. At least seven soldiers were inside at the time, and they were presumed dead due to the force of the attack. However, since then, only six of their bodies have been recovered. One of the Israeli medics I spoke to said it was a very difficult task to recover their bodies and to identify them. Now, the seventh soldier there, the one that wasn't at least originally named, is presumed to be the one that Hamas claimed to capture. The Israelis on the record are not saying what his current status is, but off the record, they're saying that he's been presumed dead and that if Hamas did capture him, it was likely that they only captured his body.
We talked about the possibility of a truce. There are negotiations, or at least talks about negotiations, going on now in Egypt. Does that seem likely at all? Or are people in Israel talking about that?
You know, there's this idea floating around that there's a need for another sort of mediator, another negotiator. The Egyptians have had a tumultuous relationship with Gaza, to say the least, and their handling of the ceasefire talks last week was widely considered to be ineffective. They kept Hamas out of the discussion. They relayed messages inconsistently to the Israelis. And so John Kerry going there, meeting with them, talking to the Egyptians, that's seen as a positive sign. But people are asking whether Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi right now has the clout to kind of push the ceasefire agreement forward.
Not only whether he has the clout, but whether he's trusted by both sides.
Yeah, exactly. There's been a clampdown on Hamas in Egypt. They've shut the Rafah crossing. And there's this idea that Hamas will not be inclined to do the Egyptians any favors anytime soon.
Now, what is the mood there in Israel? Is there support for the government continuing the ground offensive?
Very much so. I mean, despite the death of, I think at this point, over 27 Israeli soldiers, the mood in Israel is very much supportive of the troops, supportive of the Israeli offensive. There have been tiny, tiny anti-war protests, and the few protests that have been held have actually come under attack by right-wing groups. There aren't any voices, really sort of, I would say, prominent political voices in Israel who are calling for an end to Israel's engagement in Gaza.
You know, with all these situations, there's generally talk at some point about a tipping point. How many casualties is too many for both sides? Is there discussion yet about that? Is there some number that's being thrown around in Israel and perhaps among Palestinians as well?
If there is, I haven't heard it. Certainly on the Palestinian side, I think the latest death toll did top 500. More Palestinians have died, more civilians have died in this conflict than have had since Operation Cast Lead in 2008. On the Israeli side, this has been the greatest loss to Israel's military since the Second Lebanon War. And the Israeli officials I spoke to in off-record conversations said they never expected to lose this many soldiers inside Gaza. So I don't know what it's going to take. I don't think it's going to be a high casualty that on either side that's going to stop the fighting. Both the Israeli and the Palestinian leadership seem to have gone all in Gaza at the moment.
Shira Frenkel, thank you as always.
Thanks.
Shira Frenkel reports from Jerusalem for BuzzFeed. 27 dead among Israeli soldiers might not sound like a lot when compared with the more than 600 dead among Palestinians in Gaza. But as Shira said, this is already one of Israel's bloodiest conflicts in years. So how has Hamas been able to inflict so many casualties? The World's Chris Wolf has been looking into that. And first, Chris, really, how does the scale of this conflict compare?
Well, one figure really sums it up, Aaron, in that this is already worse than all the previous conflicts in Gaza combined since the evacuation in 2005. If you try and think of a U.S. analogy, you remember the U.S. conflict in Mogadishu in 93, the Black Hawk Down battle, and how politically traumatic that was. Israeli casualties already exceed the number that the U.S. suffered in that fight.
So what is Hamas doing differently this time around?
Well, I'm sure historians will be debating the details for years, but the broad outlines seem relatively clear. Basically, they're fighting. They're standing their ground, where before they've cut and run, shoot and scoot. There was one officer who told the Wall Street Journal that, I have to admit, we faced good fighters from the other side, terrorists, but good fighters, unquote. And they've been able to do this in a strategic sense because they've been able to draw the Israelis in to fight on Hamas's terms in positions of their choosing where Israel loses its technological edge, urban close-quarter combat.
You make it sound like, in a way, Israel got suckered in.
Well, not really. In a sense, they got drawn in by the rocket attacks and perhaps more importantly, these infiltration tunnels that haven't been getting a lot of press. But dozens of Hamas fighters have been getting out and into Israel using these tunnels that have been constructed over several years and launching raids on Israeli targets and civilians on the other side of the frontier. And it's not clear how much Israel has been surprised by this. One IDF officer told Haaretz that he's been to this place before where the big battle was on Sunday, and he says it's like nothing they've ever seen before. They were surprised by how Hamas was fighting with missile traps and IEDs everywhere.
Chris, I'm wondering about the weapons that might be being used now in Gaza. We know that the rockets that they're firing at Israel are more advanced than they've been before. Any indication over whether the weaponry inside Gaza is different somehow?
Yes, Aaron, they've got more of it and they've got weapons with longer range. But perhaps more importantly, what's become apparent is this enormous infrastructure that they've got underpinning it. And it's literally underground. It appears to be a massive network of tunnels and bases, all interconnected, all reinforced. This is where Hamas has its war bunkers. This is where Hamas, as leaders and their families, are hiding out. And this is how they're being able to keep going. They wheel out the rockets from one of these positions. They launch them and get the fighters and the launch equipment back under cover, often before Israel has a chance to respond. So that's another thing that's completely new.
That's very reminiscent of the tactics used by Hezbollah in their fight against Israel in 2006.
Right. It's clear that they've been studying what Hezbollah achieved. And I think this probably suggests that they are hoping to achieve a victory like Hezbollah is perceived to have achieved, at least in parts of the Middle East, in being able to stop the Israeli Defense Forces in 2006 in that conflict in Lebanon. And it would be an enormous coup for Hamas to be able to pull off something similar in the current conflict.
So all this you're saying suggests that, future casualties could go up for the Israeli army.
Yes, unless Israel is prepared to hand Hamas that kind of propaganda victory we were just talking about. More importantly, perhaps the casualties amongst Palestinians and particularly Palestinian civilians are going to be mounting as well, simply because a lot of these Hamas positions have been prepared, at least according to the IDF, deliberately in densely populated areas next to hospitals, mosques and schools, the kind of thing that will be damaged if this fighting intensifies.
The world's history and defense specialist, Chris Wolfe. One Hamas rocket fired today landed close to Israel's main international airport in Tel Aviv. That led U.S. Airlines, Delta, United and U.S. Airways to cancel their flights to Israel today. The FAA then added its own 24-hour ban on American flights to Israel. Several European carriers followed suit, including Lufthansa, KLM, and Air France. Aviation experts say airlines are extra wary of such risk right now in the wake of last week's air disaster in Ukraine. Back to Gaza now and to that rising Palestinian death toll we mentioned earlier. It now stands at more than 600 people killed, many of them civilians. That sparked angry protests among Palestinians in the West Bank. But those protests are usually shut down pretty quickly, often by the West Bank's own Palestinian security forces. Here's more from Rebecca Collard in Ramallah.
A few hundred Palestinians demonstrate against Israel's bombardment of the Gaza Strip, draped in traditional Palestinian keffiyeh and hoisting placards calling Israel's attack on Gaza not war but genocide. They march down a main street in Ramallah. Their destination is Beit Eil, an Israeli settlement and military installation in the heart of the West Bank. But they are stopped, not by the Israeli army, but by a row of around 40 Palestinian police officers with riot shields and batons. The crowd chants for them to open the road, but they hold their position. The anger now is not just directed against Israel, but also against their own Palestinian government. Basma is among the protesters.
We couldn't make it because, as you see, there's the Palestinian security forces. They are here and they blocked the way in front of us to reach there.
Under the Oslo Accords, American-trained Palestinian security forces are mandated to cooperate with Israel. This cooperation includes controlling protests, arresting activists and militants, and even planning the assassination of a shared Hamas political foe. And when the Israeli army wants to enter a Palestinian area, Palestinian forces stand down. Basma is appalled by the deal.
Unfortunately, till now, our authority is still considered this security coordination as a sacred agreement, which is, we feel, it's a humiliation for our rights and it's a humiliation for us. Because in this way, they protect the Israelis and attacking us.
In the last two decades, security cooperation has remained intact, though often covertly. Only at the height of the Second Intifada, for a few years, did this agreement break down, as some of the Palestinian security forces turned against the Israeli army. But even during Israel's Operation Cast Lead in 2008, which killed over 1,300 Palestinians in Gaza, the Palestinian Authority forces in the West Bank continued this cooperation. Halil Shaheen is director of research at the Palestinian Center for Policy Research and Strategic Studies. He chides the Palestinian Authority for not playing its cards right to protect Palestinian lives.
One of the most effective cards is stopping the security coordination with the Israelis, because Israel should know that there is a price for its continuous policies.
Many at this protest are asking the Palestinian leadership to use their bargaining chips now as a way to end the offensive in Gaza.
They are standing still. It's the 10th day of the offensive and they still haven't taken any concrete measures to alleviate the pain that our people are living in.
For Basil Abid, cooperation with the Israeli army, particularly while that army attacks Gaza, is unacceptable.
And I think security coordination is at the base of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, because it kind of puts another occupation but in Palestinian military or civilian clothes. So it's much more hurtful than the Israeli occupation, actually. The oppressor becomes your own people.
As Israel escalates its offensive in Gaza, it's unlikely there will be any disruption to this cooperation. And for many, like Basil, this feels doubly oppressive. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard in Ramallah.
Coming up, rhino horn. What is it good for? Turns out not much, at least not much more than a good protein powder, but Asia still wants more. That story and the latest on the downed Malaysian airline on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter, and you've got the world on your radio. If it's summer in New York, you can bet the public courts will be packed. There's pickup basketball, soccer, handball, even cricket. But if you're in Chinatown, look twice at those guys playing volleyball. It's actually something called Nine Man. Bruce Wallace has our story.
A whistle, a serve. The ball rockets across the asphalt court. It's volleyed, set up, and a player leaps to slam it back over the net. It's met by a wall of six airborne players. One of them shoots the ball back across the net and scores. 1 point for the serving side. It was my first time seeing a game of nine man. It's like volleyball, but teams have, you guessed it, nine players per side. Volleyball typically has six. That means more hands at the net, longer volleys, and some really intense points. It was the perfect weekend to check out the sport. A tournament was on, ahead of a national championship over Labor Day weekend. And it was happening in Manhattan's Chinatown, the kind of place where nine man first took hold in the U.S. It was during the 1930s, when U.S. federal law restricted Chinese immigration. Families were separated, and men left alone in the U.S. bonded over the sport.
And so during that exclusionary period, it was essentially an isolated bachelor society in America in the Chinatowns across the U.S.
Tom Fong has been playing nine man in Washington, D.C. for three decades.
And so cooks, laundry workers would find creative ways to entertain themselves within their insular communities. And so they remembered the game that they played back in Toisan, China.
It's unclear how this style of volleyball originally got to the city of Toisan in southern China. Some say it was introduced by missionaries. Others think it was brought back by Chinese immigrants returning from the West. However it happened, it then started popping up in Chinatowns in the U.S. And there's one position in the sport that's for sure my favorite. It's called suicide.
Suicide is the person that picks up all the hooks, the really fast ones, so it's all coming to your face, so it's kind of dangerous, I guess.
Benny Wong is 21 years old and moved to New York 7 years ago from Toisan. His dad played nine man there. And the more we talked about nine man, the more I thought about playing myself. But I can't play, at least not officially. I'm not Asian. Current competition rules require that two-thirds of the players on the court must be 100% Chinese, and the rest of the players must be of Asian descent. Some say these rules are discriminatory, but Danny Moy disagrees. He organized the tournament in New York and says it's about maintaining the game's history and about how Chinese immigrants here once fought being marginalized.
It's part of traditions, right? And I think, for me, I'm old school, so I like to keep traditions. And it's important. If we don't do it, then it's going to die out.
Dying out isn't likely. Player Tom Fong says the number of teams competing in the National Labor Day Tournament has doubled in the 30 years he's been involved in the sport. And he says the level of play is getting way better.
Now, you see these guys that are 6'2", 6'5", former college players, former pro beach players who play the sport, right alongside grandkids of those original founders of this game in the U.S.
And the national tournament that D.C. hosted last year was a far cry from the early days, when restaurant workers put up nets across Chinatown back alleys.
We held it on the streets of Washington, D.C., not just any street, Pennsylvania Avenue. And so we shut down Pennsylvania Avenue for a glorious couple of days. And right there are the shadows of the U.S. Capitol, the Washington Monument, the White House. It was kind of a statement. We've come a long way since the exclusionary period.
In recent years, a nine-man team from Toronto has dominated the scene. Crowds packed the court in New York when they came down to face another Canadian team last Sunday. I, rather unprofessionally, found myself taking sides, rooting for the underdog. I did manage to keep myself from dropping a bet with some of the old-timers hanging out along the fence. The underdogs ended up winning, though. It would have been a good bet. For The World, I'm Bruce Wallace, New York City.
Rhino horn is pretty popular in Asia, not to mention illegal. Every year, poachers kill hundreds of rhinos in South Africa and sell their horns on the black market in East Asia. The horns are ground up into medicines or displayed in homes as status symbols. Kruger National Park is South Africa's largest game reserve and a big destination for international tourists. Officials there are considering moving some of their rhinos out of the park to cull the herd and to protect them from poachers. Kathy Dean is director of Save the Rhino International, based in London. She says that the park has other reasons for relocating some rhinos as well.
Kruger National Park have very large, healthy populations of black and white rhinos. And in order to keep them breeding and being optimally productive, occasionally you have to destock parks. And so every year there are live game auctions so that they've got enough food, they've got enough water, they've got enough territory.
Can I buy one?
You certainly could if you had enough money.
How much does a rhino go for?
I'm not completely up to date with figures, but you're talking about $300,000, $400,000.
Ah, okay. The stories now are that the rhinos are being moved to keep them safe from poachers who are coming in from Mozambique next door. Why is that an especially dangerous spot?
Sure. Well, Kruger National Park has a particular geographical problem. It's a long rectangular shape, and it's the long eastern boundary is the international border between South Africa and Mozambique. And a couple of decades ago, conservationists, governments all agreed that it would be great to take down fences around the edges of Kruger National Park and to open up what's known as transfrontier conservation areas, which is a great idea in principle. Animals roam wildly. They might seasonally migrate. They don't have to go through international passport controls and so on. It's a fantastic vision. The problem is that Mozambique was in a civil war for two decades. And when that ended in the early 90s, there are a lot of guns left. And despite many years of international aid pouring into Mozambique, that aid hasn't really reached the people on the ground. There is massive corruption at government level, and those funds are being siphoned off. So you do have very poor, very disadvantaged people who don't have a sustainable means of generating income to feed their families and so on. And so they think, well, it's worth the risk to go and poach rhinos in Kruger National Park. So they can simply walk across the border and walk back across the border. And at the moment, South African rangers are not allowed to chase them across the border. They have to stop when they get to that invisible line.
What are the long-term repercussions of this poaching problem? Is the rhino population in long-term danger?
Absolutely. So if the poaching trend continues to increase, that will mean that overall rhino numbers will go into decline at the end of this year or early next, and that they could go extinct by 2026. Now, I want to caveat that and say that in practice, I really don't think they will be allowed to go extinct. But what it means is that rhinos will end up in Fort Knox type situations, surrounded by meters of barbed wire. It won't be everybody's fantasy of what wildlife in Africa looks like. You know, it'll be a couple of hundred animals locked up inside a fenced area. That's not what we want.
Kathy Dean is the director of Save the Rhino International, a rhino conservation organization based in London. And Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter. Ahead, fond memories of a radio show in Somalia that helps reunite families.
He said, oh yeah, no, I've always remembered that show when I was a young kid, about 7 years old in Mogadishu. I suddenly remember the neighbour jumping up and down and starting to cry. And the reason? Her husband had called out for her on the Missing Persons show.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The rebels in eastern Ukraine have kept their word. As promised, they handed over the black boxes from Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 early this morning. The boxes, which are actually painted orange, not black, were given to a Malaysian official at a ceremony in the rebel-held city of Donetsk. But the calls continue today for the pro-Russian separatists to let international investigators have full and unrestricted access to the site where Flight 17 fell to earth. Natalia Antilava is in Donetsk for the BBC. And Natalia, what is the latest on the ground at the crash site? Can you still just kind of walk around and pick stuff up?
Yes, you can walk around and pick stuff up. There are gunmen that are guarding the road, but it's very clear that the rebels who are trying hard to be cooperative. And I think that has to do with a larger picture of the crisis in Ukraine and the pressure that they're feeling and the worries that they have that they've talked about to date with me about Putin abandoning them completely. So they're trying to be cooperative. So they are letting people in and people are sort of wandering around. It wouldn't be easy to secure this site. It is huge. I mean, it's a massive land area. But this is a really big deal for the investigation, because the thing is, even though the black boxes have been finally been handed over, the crucial information may not even be in the black boxes.
As you say, the black boxes have been handed over to Malaysian authorities. What do you think this cooperation of Malaysia with a group of rebels says about the government in Kiev?
Well, what it says about the government in Kiev is that government in Kiev has no control over what's happening in the city of Donetsk and in the areas nearby. They control this part of the country, and we have known it all along. It was very striking to watch last night what a stretched out, unnecessarily so, process that handover of the black boxes became, because the Malaysians were waiting in the hotel. They were told they would be given the boxes. Then the self-appointed prime minister of the self-declared People's Republic of Donetsk, Alexander Borodoy, came to the hotel holding a pistol, smoking a cigarette. But he then talked to the Malaysians, then left, and they announced that the official handover ceremony would be at midnight in his headquarters. So journalists were invited, everyone piled in, and Mr. Borodoy, who is actually a Russian citizen and allegedly a former military intelligence operative, he was referred to as His Excellency by the Malaysians, and he insisted that the sides would have to sign the memorandum of understanding. So they turned this whole thing into a ceremony of sorts. And painful as this process was all along, it may not even give us that much. The aviation experts that we're talking to are saying that there may be nothing in those black boxes because of the nature of the crash. If it was a missile, which everyone believes that it was, the explosion would have been very sudden, and the crucial information is much more likely to be on site in the traces of the explosives, in the way that shrapnel hit and so on, rather than in the black boxes, which is why it's so important to gain full access immediately, although many fear it also may be too late.
And finally, Natalia, the investigation is still having to go forward in the middle of what is essentially a war zone. Has there been some kind of ceasefire to facilitate the cleaning up or investigating the crash?
Yes, Ukrainian authorities announced a ceasefire, unilateral ceasefire, in the area, in the 60-mile area around the crash. And the rebels also made it very clear that they will make sure that the investigators have safe access to that area. But again, just as the Malaysians arrived this morning, we heard very loud thumps of the Grand rockets. Someone somewhere was shelling, and it could have been the Ukrainian side, or it could have been the rebels. We don't know who it was, but this is indeed a war zone, and there's fighting that's going on, and there are buildings that are being shelled regularly, and people who are being killed and wounded.
The BBC's Natalia Antolava will check back with you soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The agony continues for the families of 219 missing schoolgirls in Nigeria. It's now been 100 days since the girls were abducted by the extremist group Boko Haram. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan marked the occasion by meeting with some of the girls' relatives. The kidnapping has been an unresolved tragedy for the families. But they also have to contend with an ongoing Boko Haram assault on their hometown of Chibok. Several fathers of missing girls have reportedly been killed in the fighting. Chude Jidonwo is a Nigerian journalist and lawyer in Lagos. He says the parents' meeting with Nigeria's president today didn't include others who wanted to be there.
None of the members of the Citizens Action Group, Bring Back Our Girls, was allowed to follow the parents into the meeting, which was a bit worrisome. Members of the press were asked out of the meeting, which was also a bit worrisome. And because these are not even middle-class parents, not a lot of them have engaged on this kind of level before. But, you know, we want to hope for the best. This is their government. The government is responsible for the safety of citizens of the country. And so one is hopeful that these parents will not be intimidated, but that there will be some constructive feedback that will comfort them and give them hope that the girls will be back very soon.
We learned today that 11 of the parents of the girls have died since their daughter's abduction by the Boko Haram group. That seems a bit shocking. Is that surprising to you?
It is shocking. It is depressing. It's unacceptable, but it's not altogether surprising. You must remember that Chibok is a relatively poor community, you know, that has suffered relentless attacks by Boko Haram. There's been almost 1,000% reinforcement of security troops, but the security troops are not doing much to instill confidence in the citizens. There are no major hospitals in that area, certainly none that have taken responsibility for the mental health of these people. There has been no governmental representation to comfort them or to otherwise engage them and support them at such a difficult time. The Bimbaka Girls campaign has tried to do that, but it is also a citizen-led campaign, so it is neither funded nor equipped to perform the role of an alternative government. So the parents have essentially been on their own. They haven't even had any structured meetings with federal government officials to get a status update until today as to what exactly has been happening with their children. To that extent, it's not surprising that, you know, many of them have been defeated in spirit and eventually passed on. But it is depressing because these are citizens of Nigeria who deserve better.
Trude, in a cruel twist of fate, some of the parents were actually killed in another raid by Boko Haram.
The country is beset by problems, you know, of insecurity, especially across board. And so citizens daily have a sense that we are not safe. However, this stands out because of the sheer monstrosity that Boko Haram has dealt in this case. And so we're all just praying and hoping and working and protesting and demanding that it doesn't get worse. But the truth is that, yes, Boko Haram has hoisted its flag in at least two villages in the northeast. You know, it's just a sad, sad state of affairs.
Yeah, just over the weekend, they grabbed what some are calling a major town of Damboa.
Yes. The Nigerian government says that it is doing its very best to solve this problem. And a part of me wants to believe that the government is doing it's trying to do its best to solve the problem. I think it speaks to a much deeper question of the capacity of our security forces, of the motivation of our security forces, and of the steady progress that we have allowed Boko Haram make over the past few years in terrorizing citizens, so that it has built such a massive bulwark of confidence that it certainly feels that it can run down any village or any town that it desires in the northeast. So this is not just a problem of this missing 219 girls. It's a question of the total breakdown of law and order that didn't start with this government, certainly, but of course it is responsibility to deal with. Every time Boko Haram attacks or strikes or takes charge of a village or anything else, it just reminds us that the war on terror is not one that we are winning on our own terms.
I wonder whether this is still in the minds of most Nigerians. Are they thinking about these kidnapped girls? It's now 100 days after they were abducted.
Many Nigerians had moved on. There was a sense that we have bigger problems to deal with, or that we have other problems to deal with, and this one seemed to be intractable. However, in the last week, and thanks to the consistency of the Bring Back Our Girls protesters in Abuja, it's back on the front burner. It's back as an issue of overriding national debate. Tomorrow, it will be 100 days. The activities in conjunction with, I know, the Gordon Brown Foundation, the United Nations, and all of that. And so even if it wasn't a priority for Nigerians last week, it certainly is now.
Trude Jidanwo is a Nigerian journalist and lawyer. He joined us from Lagos, Nigeria. Trude, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Bringing you the latest news about what's happening in Nigeria or anywhere else in the world, that's part of our mission here at The World. But radio, of course, can do a lot more than just bring you the news. Our producer in London, Leo Hornack, likes to keep track of the many different ways radio is used around the globe. And over the next few weeks, he's going to share some stories with us about what he's discovered. Some of it is very basic, but extremely effective. Today, we start with this. So, Leo, that doesn't sound especially scintillating. What am I listening to there? It sounds just like people reading off names.
Well, that's exactly what it is, Aaron. Did you get most of that? Were you taking notes? Because I can tell you exactly what they were reading. That's the BBC Somali service. And they were reading out a list of names. But it's not just any list of names. It's a regular show that's been running for, you know, getting on, for, I think, for 20 years now, called Bar Finn, which means missing persons. And what this show does is, in collaboration with the International Committee of the Red Cross, is it allows Somalis who've lost people to put in their name, a small description of the person they're looking for, and it gets read out on the radio. And unfortunately, there are a lot of missing people. So according to the International Committee of the Red Cross, 12,000 names were read aloud on this show in 2012 alone. Every day, 15 minutes a day at the moment, they go through a whole list of names.
You know, Leo, in this age of the internet and Google and cell phones, especially from an American perspective, it just seems strange that radio might have this kind of reach.
Well, I mean, it is strange, and that's what kind of grabbed me when I first heard of this. I was speaking to a Somali friend of mine who lives in, he's a refugee in Kenya, and he just mentioned this show in passing as though it was something everyone would have heard of, like the news or the weather forecast. I spoke to one of the producers of the show. He used to present the show. He's called Mohammed Ali, and he works in the BBC's Nairobi Bureau, and he told me a little bit about why radio in particular is the only way this kind of service can be provided.
Internet is not accessible in most places in Horn of Africa. It's not even accessible in refugee camps. Publication of newspaper requires literacy. There are no many people who can read and write. So radio now becomes the medium that can cut across all these barriers, where you not need electricity, where you not need to have infrastructure like internet. So I think it's the most accessible, easily affordable medium of communication in the Horn of Africa.
Leo, as you mentioned, the radio read off 12,000 names in 2012 alone. It's a lot of people, but I guess the big question is, does it work? Have friends and family been reunited?
The answer is it does work. And the evidence for that, I mean, evidence being collected by the Red Cross, but the sort of most powerful evidence is kind of anecdotal and is in people's personal stories. As I said, this friend of mine who first told me about the show, he's a Somali refugee. He lives in Kenya. And he just mentioned, he said, oh, yeah, no, I've always remembered that show. When I was a young kid, about 7 years old in Mogadishu, I suddenly remember the neighbor jumping up and down and starting to cry. And the reason? Her husband had called out for her on the missing persons show, and they were going to be reunited. She hadn't seen him in a decade. And, you know, that's just one of the stories that you come across when you speak to Somalis in the whole Somali diaspora. I mean, the Red Cross themselves, who do this in collaboration with the BBC, have been collecting these stories. And if you go to PRI.org, you can see one of the videos they made, an interview with a mother who got reunited with her daughter. It's a very powerful story, but it's not unusual. This, unfortunately, if you are a young or even a middle-aged or even a very old Somali, you will have relatives who have got lost or have been separated from in the conflict.
Our producer in London, Leo Hornack, thank you very much.
No problem, Aaron.
We want to hear your stories of reuniting with loved ones, whether as refugees or some other way. Share your family reunion tale with us at PRI.org or go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/PRI The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and you're listening to The World. This week, we're talking about where English started. We'll hear more about that in a couple of minutes. But first, we're going to take a quick look at a place where the language landed and flourished. I'm not talking about the U.S. I'm talking about India. English is one of the official languages there. It helps knit the country together. But India's new Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, isn't a big fan. He rarely gives speeches in English, preferring to stick with Hindi. Many see that as a political preference. Our friend Deepak Singh has been thinking a lot about English versus Hindi lately. He lives in South Bend, Indiana, but this summer he's visiting his family back home in India.
I've been living in the U.S. for 11 years, so I speak and hear English language all the time. But I often crave Hindi, my first language, and one of the official languages of India. So before I left America to spend the summer with my family in India, I promised myself I'd only read Hindi language books and speak mostly in Hindi. It hasn't been that easy. A few days after I arrived, I set out to buy a short story collection by a famous Hindi writer, Munshi Premchand. I went to a well-known bookseller in my hometown, Lucknow, the heartland of Hindi language, but I learned that he only sells books in English now. At another bookshop, the shopkeeper pointed to an isolated corner where they had Hindi books. I bought one and took it to an upscale cafe next door. The cashier and waiters only wanted to communicate in English, no matter how much I tried to speak Hindi. I took a sip of coffee and opened my book. Just as I started reading, I heard the Miley Cyrus song, Wrecking Ball. I noticed a group of teenage girls a few tables away, singing along, shoulder dancing. When I was growing up in India, I went to an English school where students were fined for speaking in Hindi. Flunking Hindi class was almost a matter of pride. My parents wanted me to be fluent in English because it came with the promise of a good career, wealth, and status. Now India's new Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, wants civil servants to use Hindi instead of English. They've even been urged to communicate in Hindi on Twitter, Facebook, and other social media. I finished my coffee and walked out of the cafe thinking, where am I going to find someone who won't speak in English? Maybe I should ask the Prime Minister.
That's writer Deepak Singh in Lucknow, India. All this week, we're visiting places in Britain that are of special linguistic significance, places that help more than most to shape the English language. We begin today pretty near the beginning of English, in a part of England where the accent has been around for almost as long as the people have. Here's the world's language editor, Patrick Cox.
Dialects are fading away in Britain, but they haven't disappeared yet. Far from it. One of the best known and least penetrable to outsiders is the Geordie accent, spoken in Newcastle and other parts of northeast England.
If that's the worst thing he's ever done in his career, I took a chicken sandwich to his room when he was with the England camp, and then who knows, there wouldn't be even sleeping tablets in that camp, that's for sure.
See what I mean? Much of the region where this dialect is spoken is a post-industrial place today. Shipbuilding, coal mining, they're gone, replaced by call centres, office parks and a container ship port. Something else too.
On this site we've got pigs and sheep and goats, cattle.
And ducks. All kinds of farmyard animals, including some ancient varieties, more popular 1,400 years ago than they are now, like this shaggy-haired pig.
Yeah, that is actually half a ton of very, very grumpy animal, and it's only interesting if you, A, if you're going to feed it, and B, if you fall in which case you are food.
Point taken. Thank you, John Sadler. Sadler is the living history coordinator of this place. It's called Bede's World. The animals are part of a recreation of an Anglo-Saxon village. There are timber-framed buildings here, part of a farm called Yearway. That's Old English. Next door is a monastery that really is old. It was the home of a monk known as the Venerable Bede.
He's famous as a writer and as a teacher. And of course, he has this keen interest in history and in language.
Bede wrote an ecclesiastical history of the nation at the time. We're talking 7th century here.
Taking up the story now is linguist David Crystal.
And he's the first person to actually write down who it was that actually came to the British Isles. He talks about the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes and discusses the range of languages that are spoken around the country.
These were the languages that arrived in Britain after the Romans had left. The newcomers, these Angles, Saxons and Jutes, they found themselves in a place already heaving with languages, Celtic ones, as well as bits and pieces of languages left behind by Roman mercenaries who came from all over the empire, which explains why English, from its very beginnings, was a mongrel tongue, a Frisian word here, a Latin one there, and so on. Pure English? It never existed. Now, these waves of migrants, they also help form the dialects that you can still hear in Britain. On average, there's a different one for every 25 miles you travel.
It all goes back to those original days when the people from Denmark, as it were, settled in one part of the country, the people from another part of Northern Europe settled somewhere else. You only have to settle on the other side of a river, on the other side of a mountain range. And before you know it, you know, within a few years, you're starting to speak in a slightly different way, and after 100 years, a very different way from what it was before.
This is one of the reasons Bee's writings are so valuable. They've helped linguists trace the origins of today's dialects. Of course, the migration didn't stop there. Vikings, Normans, and much later, Irish, Jamaican, Indians, and others, they've all left their stamp on Britain's dialects.
Morning, gentlemen. Morning.
Morning, Jimmy. You all right?
We're inside Bede's church now, the bit of it that dates back to the 7th century. John Sadler shows me his favourite thing here.
And it is said that this chair here is Bede's chair.
Tell me why you laughed at that.
Because it's actually impossible to say whether it is original or whether it might be a subsequent copy.
It looks old enough, and if it is a copy, it seems fitting. The monk who may or may not have sat on it was documenting a language that itself copied and borrowed and stole from other languages. English, like the people who spoke it then and speak it today, is a fabulous hodgepodge. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
Tomorrow we'll hear how Shakespeare exploited that hodgepodge.
I mean, Shakespeare's language is full of resonances of Latin, of Spanish, of Germanic terms. I think it was Borges who talked about him as the most Spanish of writers. And the Irish have often said, you know, actually, Shakespeare, it's a myth, he's English, he's actually Irish.
Shakespeare's multilingual roots tomorrow on The World. And we leave you today with more of that Geordie accent from Newcastle, a song called Fog on the Tyne by the 1970s group Lindisfarne. This version is from 1990 with updated lyrics from Geordie soccer star Paul Gascoigne. Good luck figuring out what he's saying.
Sitting in a sleazy snack bar, sucking sickly sausage rolls, in a dirty old town on the back of the Tyne, setting my sights on gold. It's plain to see, it's black and white, this Geordie boy's gonna do all right. Gonna make you dance, gonna make you sing, those Geordie boys do anything. Tell it like it is, today we'll take its time to tell you what tonight might bring. They'd spur you on in London town when you hear those Geordie sing, sing.
That's our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH. I'm Aaron Schachter. Thanks for listening.
Everybody do their thing. You'll know for sure that they're in town when you hear those.